This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm going to move this here. My name is Mark Lancaster, and I know some people, and some people I don't know, but I'm a priest at San Francisco Zen Center, and I've been over there. I just realized recently someone said, how long have you been around? I'm looking older, I guess. How long have you been around this place? It's been about 25 years now. Most of the, half of the time I worked outside and lived outside, and I was a commuter practitioner, always driving. I had my suit and my briefcase in my trunk, and I'd run the Zen Center, put on a robe, and then go downtown and switch again. And then in the last maybe 10 years, I've lived as a resident in Zen Center housing with my partner, my wife. And so that's me, and I wanted to thank Abbot Mio, who had to dash to the pharmacy. So tell him I thanked him for inviting me. He says he's coming back. And Joseph Tetsugan, thanks for setting this up and sending me information and reminding me. I had it in my calendar, but it's always nice to be reminded in time too, and you did it very nicely. Sometimes I've been the guy who comes at 9:45 and rings the doorbell, you know. It's Lancaster, they're ringing the doorbell at the wrong time. So it's nice to know the ins and outs of things. Life has its dimensions, its boundaries, its way of flowing, and it's good to flow with it in correctness, you could say, which isn't uptightness, but it's actually more of a dance. And sometimes we step on each other's toes, and sometimes we're in beautiful harmony. And then we have to make adjustments. So today I wanted to talk about a topic I'm titling Spiritual Inquiry and Spiritual Community. You know, this process of, you know, I think at some point we go along in our lives and you know, things seem all right, and then at some point we begin to become aware that something may be amiss, that there's some grid or some difficulty, and at that point you know, it's pretty reasonable to look around. What's going on here? You know, I've done all the things I'm supposed to do. My teeth are good, and you know, I voted in the last election, and yet there's some unease in my heart, you could say. You know, some place that's not being touched or met. And so then we begin a different kind of journey, a different kind of inquiry into the situation of birth and death, of suffering and liberation. Those are big terms, and they're actually very concretely done when we begin to stop, you know, for the first time in that onward rush of getting things done, being successful, being self-critical, the ceaseless activity of our life, of our well-intentioned life. Nobody sets out to become unhappy. We all want to avoid suffering and to become truly happy. And you know, at some time we see that perhaps our first approach has some problems with it, some difficulties. And, you know, the inquiry or the change comes from all of our, you could say, our karmic dispositions, all of the things that led up to this point, and also the place we're at. You know, you, I would say in one sense you could say this is an effect of your karmically fortunate that you have a place like this in a state with a bright sunshine and abundant food, and that you're born into this karmic realm where, you know, we have health care and sustenance in order to make this inquiry. So it's a very fortunate situation that we find ourselves in. And of course, you know, when you begin the inquiry, it's not just an internal inquiry. If you're in a place where there is no food, you may have the heart of practice, and yet you're overcome by the misfortune of this difficult birth. Or you could be born in the, even in a place like, you know, the plain state of Nebraska, where you want to do something, but yet, what will you do? And so our mind naturally is enlivened or turns when there's a possibility of Dharma, there's a possibility of the teaching being available. And yet, you know, sometimes, you know, we persist. You know, people can say, something's amiss. I think I can fill it with more activity, more sense delights, more cars and more people and more sex or more political correctness. So we try to fill this place that's not satisfied you. And I wouldn't see it as an absolute place. Let's just say it's also a karmic hinge of some discomfort. There's some unease in there. So, and sometimes people are very successful at acquiring things, and they can fill their whole lives with this filling in or backfilling this want in different ways. So again, different karmas, different situations. In some ways, oddly, the fortuitous nature of the place to go and the difficulty that brought you here, you could say negative and positive, have worked very effectively. You know, that sometimes you need a level of difficulty in order to stop, to say something's just not going to work. I'm just not going to get it right in the old way. And again, our predispositions, and by disposition I mean the filters that we built up over one lifetime, and if you believe in reincarnations, myriad lifetimes of forming our relationship to what we see as objective or separate reality, condition our next choices. On that ground, Buddha still says, although karma has this difficult tendency, the preponderance of the flow, yet you can do something. You can begin to take some action of a specific nature, of a specific sort. And at that point, you know, I don't even know if we put it into words, but the wordless yearning, I think, or need, is probably beyond words. It's more like a deep quality, you know, a quality that's manifesting itself. And so then we do something. If we're in this fortuitous situation, we start to make inquiries. You know, if you're in Nebraska, you don't have this, you buy a book on spiritual training. You could be in San Francisco and buy a book on spiritual training. You talk with people. And again, if you're fortuitous, you run into somebody. Now, often, of course, you run into somebody because now you're looking, by the way. It's your own propulsion not to suffer and to be happy that helps you find these people that are around you all the time. We call them, you know, situations. Call them people, you could say great beings or great opportunities are abundant. But you need to have the request. It's like the Christian, ask truly and you will receive. It's in the question. And then sometimes we have to learn the nature of question and answer, a response and inquiry, and how intimately they're connected. Rumi said, our deep longing is God's answer. You know, we're always looking elsewhere. So we look into this place. And then maybe we're lucky and we find a community, you know, a community, and we make some changes in our life, some shift happens, and we find a spiritual friendship, which is a great gift of Dharma. Someone you can open your heart to, you can talk with. We find a teacher or teachers in Sangha. And, you know, the Buddha teaching of the three bodies of Buddha, the Nirmanakaya, is the physical manifestation. It's as though the Dharmakaya has to be made, or the truth has to be made manifest in flesh and blood. We relate in this human realm in that way. So we need to see it. We need to see it, an example, what's happening. And we need to relate or mirror it, practice in that way. So often, you know, we enter into this, I need help, literally we're saying, and I'm going outside what I'm used to or I'm comfortable with. It's a huge step, this now stopping in this forward rush in our lives to stop and be open now. And this is very difficult because, you know, it's often frightening to say you need help when you're an adult and you've been voting and you have a car. It feels, makes you feel maybe disempowered. And so then you want to, again, do more things to feel empowered. In a sense, Buddhism is just the opposite on the ground of, you could call it disempowerment and openness. We actually become, for the first time, potentially powerful. We begin the process of becoming truly seated in our own lives. Zen uses the phrase of authentic being. We grow up. We start to grow up. And so we find this community, and this is, and by the way, I'm liberally borrowing from a lecture given by Abbot Norman Fisher at Zen Center in the 90s. And he called it stages of monastic life, and I'm turning it a little bit to stages of spiritual life and using parts of it and reshaping it. So just want to give credit where credit is due. He talked about these various stages of spiritual development. And so we enter into, sometimes it's even a blissful period, you know, when we first find friendship and community or a great book, you know, suddenly it hits this place and we're, our energy comes up. Oh my gosh, something's going on. Something's going on. And, you know, for a time, you know, everything seems kind of perfect. You know, our friends, our spiritual friends are perfect. And the teaching is exquisite. And our teachers are well-dressed. And they seem to know what they're doing. And we feel like everything is now, you know, this is it. I'm on the right path. So in one sense, this is very encouraging and gives us some lift. So how we use our senses, wholesomely or unwholesomely, you could call it wholesome, meaning redeemed or integrated in a powerful way, or letting them diffuse. So this feeling of lift is pretty wholesome. But often it starts to wear off. A year goes by, and the cushions aren't as good as they should be, and the teaching, I don't know, I thought Mark was pretty good, but now I can see he's a little flaky, and I don't think he knows his stuff after all, you know. And I saw him, and they had brownies, and he took three when other people only had one. What a poor example of, you know, and he talks about greed, or, you know, and so everything, and, you know, even the food, you know, at Zen Center, it's like big discussions, you know, the food, squash soup again. You know, don't they know we're doing spiritual work here? And they don't care about us, and we pay our fun money for this. Ah, big cheat. So we feel a little bit betrayed almost. You know, we feel a little unhappy with the situation. It's a little edgy again. You know, what we thought was a the final solution or a way that we were going to be cared for maybe has some problems in it, some gritty areas that now we're seeing again. And of course, if we thought the object was separate from the subject, that the karmic flow or the relationship between the two wasn't dynamic, we then could say, I need to get a better teacher, a better temple, a better situation, and then this will be corrected. This will be corrected for me. It's a very tricky place in our practice, and I think we go in and out of it sometimes for many years. We can stay in a very blissful place for a long time, get this, get discontented and come back over and over, try. And it's a very tricky place for teachers as we enter this phase of, Norman used the word disappointment, and I sometimes, if it's really severe, you could call it the great betrayal. You promise so much, and yet here I am. I'm still here with my delusions, my anger, my neuroses, my fundamental discomfort, and I'm not fixed up. In a way, it's very childlike, you could say. It's that level. And we all do this, by the way. We're all little Buddhas in the making. So I think these stages we go through, we get very hurt. I want to get fixed up. I want this to kind of be over, take my pain away. So we feel betrayed. So part of the betrayal is, again, this seeing in the objective the solution, as though the objective exists silent. It's as though the objective framework you're in, or the phenomenal framework, exists separate from you, in phenomenology, you would say, it would be like we posit one objective stream, which is absolutely separate, and then a second one, which is related to our consciousness, as though they're simultaneously happening. So we question, is there really two streams here, or is there just the subjective-objective karmic stream of the same stuff from different points of view that's happening? So at this point of disappointment, we can turn away and say, okay, I'm going to try something different. And you may have to leave for a time and do something radical, go to Nepal or climb a mountain. And it may be what you need to do, by the way. It may be what you need to do. I think everybody is finding the nutrient needed for practice. Sometimes skillfully and sometimes not skillfully, but we're finding it slowly in our own way. So patience with yourself. I'm going to do this. I'm going to walk around the sacred mountain for a year. I'm going to live on pizza, and go to all the movies I can see. Honestly, at times it's unknown how the Dharma manifests itself. And you have to be careful when you're acting as a teacher to give your best advice, but also respect the person's practice. So then the disappointment, things seem kind of second rate, in the temple. Gosh, it's not so good here after all. Now the dilemma is, there's always some truth in this. You may actually have been in an area where the food isn't so good at your temple, and there are endemic problems there. I mean, there have been eras in American Buddhism where teachers have been downright toxic. You've really landed in the soup. Now what are you going to do? This can be very damaging for people, because the inner and outer tangle gets mixed up. It gets very mixed up then. And the force of the negativity overwhelms the ability to see that it's the eye that's cloudy and not the visual object. There's a relationship happening here. So without denying this is difficult, what do we do now? This is one of my favorite koans of Isan Dorsey is, you get the karma you deserve, whether you deserve it or not. Now what? So this puts you back in the seat of, what are you going to do? It seems like it's unfair, but on that ground, you can slip into despair and being a victim. What are you going to do is, you can do something. When my teacher Michael uses this phrase, help is not on the way, you know, he means it as an encouragement, although people, it's a gestalt, how you take that. Are you encouraged or are you frightened? Help is not on the way, you know. What are you going to do? What are you going to do in this very tricky situation you find yourself in, imperfect surround and this need or this request? What do we do now? In some ways, I wouldn't want to use the word practice really begins there, although you could argue that when you get into that gritty phase after the first round, this is the invitation to practice. And in fact, you're now seated with yourself, the same self you came in with, who's got a little energy and lift. You've got to now work with the same dilemmas, the same difficulties. And this usually is, not usually, this is the antidote to being in despair and leaving or giving up. What brought you here? You know, what was the fundamental thing you came seeking? Even if you don't know, keep that alive. You go back to this intention. We confuse the intention, or you could say the absolute inquiry, with the relative solution. The absolute and the relative, we mix and match sometimes and get despondent. So to see both simultaneously is the work of a Buddha, not to be distracted. And we need to practice this way with the big question and the particular choices that come up. We say, form is emptiness, and emptiness itself is form. Not like form, it is form. That's a different statement. So, you know. And this is, of course, painful when your teacher says, when you're really disheveled and a mess and angry and disappointed, this is really good. It's a really irritating thing to hear, you know. It's like, oh, that's really good, you know. And sometimes it takes a long time to get there. You know, you can actually keep going for a long time between bliss and disappointment, back and forth, and stay in there until you kind of touch down back here, you know, in this karmic realm, this sentient realm of human life again. There's a koan from Michael's collection. I brought a couple of koans. I always enjoy koans now. This is from his book, 33 Fingers. And it addresses the subject object, the cloudy eye and the visual object, the deep desire and the object itself, and the differences and the problems. Who made the appointment? This is case 18. Swami Satchidananda once said, people come to me and say they're disappointed. I ask them, hey, who made the appointment? And do you get that? Who made the appointment? So we look at the teacher, not the assumptions or the inquiry. And of course, if it's a difficult out here, it can get very confusing. It can be very disruptive if you're not getting, being held, you could say. So then you have to do more work even. But this can be a karmic advantage. Now you have to dig deeper. I have to be a great student now. I have to go beyond just being satisfied with the object. I go deep, you know. No matter what happens, I go deep. This is like Suzuki Roshi and Crooked Cucumber. His teacher wasn't so good. Everyone left and he stayed. It wasn't very fortuitous. He had what I thought was a very abusive teacher. But he worked with that situation. And it forced him to go deeper than to just be a temple priest, maybe. He had to go really deep now. Michael writes, the assumptions are the questions. the answers flow from the assumptions. Expectations are difficult things, particularly unrecognized expectations. This is a bypassing. We have to always be aware of it, compassionately turn into these unexplained, these expectations or desires. Results of either fulfilled or unfulfilled expectation can lead to satisfaction or dissatisfaction. Satisfaction or dissatisfaction can lead to us feeling happy or sad about ourselves and our lives. Perhaps if they are recognized and accepted, they are just expectations, results, and emotional evaluation. Buddha would say, in the seeing, let there be the seeing. In the hearing, just let there be the hearing. But what is your deepest intention beyond results, beyond your getting or losing your appointments? So this is the, you could say, if the doubt or the disappointment is great enough, we're thrust back on a very open field again. And sometimes we can't go there. We can't go there. We move away from it again. I think I'll enter therapy or something. Not that therapy is bad, I go to a therapist, it's all good. But, so this points to this other place. This place, Norman uses the description of commitment. It's not commitment anymore to the institution, to being a good boy or girl. It's commitment to the depth of this inquiry without end. So we're pushed back in a much deeper ground. And of course, we don't know how to necessarily go there or stay there. In a sense, the disappointment, the place that's very stuck, is actually the open door of the Dharma Hall, the invitation to make this deep inquiry. Maybe one more quick go on, and then I'll sew this together, hopefully, in some way. And take a few questions, if a question, you know, if anyone wants to talk about the appointments they've made today. Wutsu's buffalo passes through the window. It's like a buffalo, this is a big water buffalo, that passes through the latticed window. Its head, horns, and forelegs all easily pass through. With a window like this. Totally preposterous image. Imagine this massive buffalo easily sliding through. Why can't its tail pass through as well? So, stuck. What is that? Problem? Opportunity. What are you going to do? You get the karma you deserve, whether you deserve it or not. Not one. So, Woman adds a verse. passing through, falling in a ditch, turning around, turning beyond, all is lost now. This tiny little tail, what a wonderful thing it is. Woman says, don't get turned around by this koan. Are you looking north at the head or south at the tail? Yeah, that's pretty much the ball of wax. Are there anybody have a comment or question? Because when we go up and have tea, it gets more desultory, and I'll tell you about my life or something. Yeah.
I appreciate your talk, and also particularly there's kind of a couple of thoughts come to mind and a question. But you gave an example where you said, also in the history of American Buddhism, people have sometimes found themselves in a genuinely kind of toxic soup in a situation that externally was really not very good.
Yeah.
And that's a very difficult place for a practitioner to be. Nonetheless, I appreciate your encouragement of finding that ground of disappointment as also a Dharma gate. Or also you get the karma you deserve or don't deserve, you know, something bad happens to you, but what can you do about it? I appreciate those messages very much. At the same time, I wonder about you know, there's always that option, you have the control to, in the midst of suffering and disillusionment and disappointment, you know, whether you made the appointment or not, to go deeper. Nonetheless, when there are external conditions that are causing a lot of suffering for other people, isn't it also a legitimate question of how can those external conditions be addressed, or what can be done about that? And also, do you ever think that message of encouraging someone to go deeper, which I think is a very good message, but it could also be used as an excuse not to address or acknowledge legitimate external suffering or toxic circumstances?
It's a great question, and that's, of course, the dilemma here. So the outer has something that needs to be fixed up, and yet it can be confused with your own spiritual inquiry. Ideally, both would continue to happen. And this is the tricky part. And it's very tricky for teachers, because when you get into that place, I think, I brought a little quote from Norma because it addresses this so well. I don't think I could do it better, if I can find it. You know, you get to that place where you see the imperfection out there, and there are things that need to be changed. And you go to people, and they seem to want to not validate what you're saying. Or they actually don't see that there's a problem. They may be very invested in the same karma of this institution. So it's very tricky how to tease those two things out. The big danger is mixing those two up, that this harmful place out here prevents you from making a true inquiry here. In other words, they get tangled up. The big thing is your true inquiry. And on that ground, are you moving or making a change based on that? Can you see the difference? And it's a very subtle area of, you could say, neither absolute right nor wrong, but what are you going to do in this situation? And it can be very crushing at that point when we get overwhelmed by this negative circumstance and we stop our own spiritual inquiry. So I think there are ways to, from that ground of being seated in your own spiritual request, holding that before you, being open to the surround of the subject object, then making statements, the best statements you can make, to keep your practice alive and maybe make it alert. Oh, sorry, somebody, this isn't a good situation. And sometimes they change and sometimes they don't. They don't. And often they're part and parcel of the place we're at, you know. There are things that just aren't so useful that are happening around us. They're probably true. But again, what do you do? And a little bit that's, I think, a personal determination. You have to also take care of your true practice, your true inquiry for yourself. And there are people, and you can say, this isn't so good, and I'm going to keep up my practice. And you can keep an and situation, rather. This isn't so good. You're absolutely better. People I actually don't understand, I give a lot of distance to. I don't have to condemn them, actually. I just say, you know, when I meet these people, I met somebody like that today, my energy dips. And I can feel it. So I think this isn't good nutrition. Just like feeding your body, you feed your practice. So it's maybe the accent on, it's your practice you're caring for, opening your heart completely and not getting waylaid by separate situations. It is an imperfect world. It will never be fixed up, you know.
Do you think there can be a danger of complacency there, though?
Can be. Yeah, it can be. It can be. You mean complacency in the institution, if you want to correct the institution?
Yeah, possibly. Or just in general, those kind of negative external circumstances. I mean, I see your point, and I think it's actually quite inspiring. Yeah. I mean, and there's a kind of an and position you can take where there's maybe only so much you can do, or maybe it won't change, but...
Yeah. We could talk more about it. I work in HR at San Francisco Zen Center, so I spend most of my time there. And you can make external adjustments that are helpful. Pretty clearly, you know, Buddhism, Nagarjuna says, not outwardly caused or inwardly created, what is the situation? It's a relationship that's happening here. So we don't deny anything out here. We simply deny that its independent existence happens. And that's where the inner and outer have to be very carefully worked with and to sustain our own practice. So, and it's not always easy, I agree. It's not always easy. Sometimes, you know, I get too invested in fixing up and I'm not listening to the heart in the situation too. What's the situation and how has it developed? And what would be perfect here, you know, at Zen Center? Do I know what would be perfect? This is kind of what it is, you know? Yeah.
I think that is the tension. I think that's not just practice, but in pretty much any situation, because my parents are lifelong Buddhists, and their attitude is unhappiness is when things are not what you want them to be. So what do you fix? Do you fix the thing so it is exactly what you want it to be? Or do you adjust your attitude so it becomes what you want it to be? But that's always the tension. Yeah. Do you work on yourself? Or do you work on the external object? Or do you do both? And I think, you know, reaching the mid-70s, struggling with that question, it becomes, I think that's why sitting and clarity sort of helps about whether it's the external situation that needs to be adjusted or it is your attitude that needs to be adjusted. Mm-hmm. And it is not always one or the other, it's always both, but to recognize reality the way it is when you look deep, when you sit with it and you see clarity.
Right.
So that helps, but in theory, but in practice, you always have that tension.
Yeah. I think that's really, really true, and pretty clearly, you know, Shakyamuni didn't sit in the marketplace. You know, he made adjustments in the externals of things too, how to eat, how to walk, how to talk. So it wasn't just, you know, that's an excess to say it's only a mental construct. This would offend against the teaching of the middle path. Only mentation exists if you have the right mental caliber. You can transcend the objective or phenomena or this affect. So pretty clearly that's becomes excessive. The other hand, of course, is I can really nail this down, the best friends, and I'll remove all of this problem, you know, get rid of it. So there's another koan, Rick Fields' koan Michael used, and then we'll probably should stop. You can move if you want to. He said Rick Fields is camping in Nepal. He's an old Zen student. And he was beside a river and he heard the water going over the rocks. And it kept him awake because it sounded like it was the Star Spangled Banner. And he got really irritated and he went out in his underwear in the dark to move the rocks around. This is the dilemma of excessive on one side. We can become, it's a wonderful solution. It's so heartfelt. But we do that a lot, you know. I only have the best friend or the best situation. I would call relative, you know. We, you know, the two work together. And sometimes they're not matched up well. We may have a big possibility and and the situation isn't right. We've landed in the soup. Okay. Yep. Yes, sir.
How do you feel sitting working in this situation?
Yeah. Well, for me, I sit now in the evenings. I try to sit an hour every day, and it's kind of like coming back to openness again. You know, I go in there. I kind of consider it like a de-emulsification chamber in one sense, de-solidifier. You know, God said that all of these crazy twists and turns and projections, you know, based on my own fear and my needs of the day, I can just let go of, you know, and there's some space in there for the first time in the day. I try to do it all day, but usually the phone rings and the president calls and the food isn't so good, that squash soup, you know. And then at the end of the day, there's space. And I get a little room for the first time between my projection and my experience to say, what is that? What is that? And I can look at it happening. Projector and screen really open now, you know. So without that, I don't know. Samsara is this web where if we don't have that opening, the seam that allows that opening, we keep recycling, we loop over and over. This allows the loop to be opened up and seen through for the first time. Without that, I couldn't do it. In my experience, I couldn't think my way out of here on my best day. Just couldn't do it. So.
Maybe one more question.
Yeah.
I think you started out saying that you were going to talk about community at some point in your beginning. And for various reasons having to do with me and maybe some atmosphere around here, I thought your subject was going to be the great benefits and greater propulsion that accrue to you through Sangha and your Sangha friends and so on. And what I was hearing was mainly the difficulties, and I wondered if I passed over too quickly something you said and didn't hear the other side.
Yeah. Good to bring this up, you know. First, the difficulties aren't in the Sangha. Again, they're co-created, this difficulty, you know. Mm-hmm. What is the perfect Sangha to begin with? What is the perfect practitioner?
Yeah.
And what's that about, the projection of perfection? Where do you want to go with that? This is the buffalo passing through the window into Satori and get the chocolate sundae. Without this, I wouldn't be, I mean, on a phenomenal basis, this has no meaning without you. My life as a priest has no existent quality without each other. We are profoundly wrapped together in this inquiry. And I get support all the time. Sometimes support I don't want. I get support that's very critical of me, by the way. But without it, again, like meditation, I would cycle through my loops, my projections. This opens the possibility of a bigger surround, of a bigger question being asked. You know, in the Lotus Sutra says, only a Buddha and a Buddha can express, not see, but express, or let enlightenment flow. Alone, I only see that half. I don't see back here. You see back here. You say, Mark, this lecture is getting really long. We have sentient legs and we should stop. So I value, like, the injunction, depend on the Sangha, flourish with the Sangha, don't bring disharmony to the Sangha. These are powerful, this is a powerful tool of enlightenment. I was more accentuating some difficulty, so I don't want to underplay. We don't do this for fun, you know. We build these chambers for reasons. for our safety and our true development. So, okay, thank you very much.
May our attention be extended to every being.